Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Senator Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. He and 26 other senators today call for a stop to the wholesale closing of rural post offices and for measures to preserve first-class mail and Saturday delivery. We will also discuss the obscene amounts of super PAC money flooding into this year's election and what can be done to overturn Citizens United. Then we'll get a reading on China's next leader, Xi Jinping, who is visiting Washington, as well as a broader assessment of China's emerging role as a global superpower. One of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, politics, and people, Perry Link, joins us to look into the current backlash from Arab countries angry at China's veto of a UN Security Council resolution aimed at stopping the Assad family dictatorship from killing the Syrian people. Then finally, we will speak with an extraordinary and humble man who has had a direct effect on nonviolent resistance tactics around the world, from Serbia to Iran, from Egypt to Russia. The founder of the Albert Einstein Institution, Gene Sharp, joins us. He is the author of a new book just out, Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language and Civil Resistance in Conflicts. I'm now joined by Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the United States Senate in 2008 to represent Vermont after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. And you, along with 26 of your colleagues in the Senate, Senator Sanders, are trying to rescue the post office. It's an extraordinary irony to think that we are speaking here on Valentine's Day, and the beloved post office in Valentine, Texas, famous for its unique Valentine's Day postmarks, is on the list of endangered post offices soon to be closed.
That's right. Here's where we are, Ian. The Postmaster General announced the plan last year, which would shut down 3,700 post offices, most of them rural, which shut down half of the mail processing plants in this country. That's about 252 of them. Would end Saturday mail delivery, would shrink the workforce of the Postal Service by about 40%, from 550,000 down to 330,000. His argument is that first-class mail is down, which is certainly true. But the other reality that we are concerned about is that every single year, the Postal Service, as a result of legislation in 2006, is obliged to come up with $5.5 billion in future employee health benefits. And that is just an onerous and unprecedented burden that no other entity in government or in the private sector comes anywhere near having to fulfill. And that has had an enormously harmful impact on the finances of the Post Office. So we think that by ending that onerous burden, which the Inspector General of the Post Office says is no longer needed because there is already $44 billion in that fund, and moving the Post Office into a more entrepreneurial mode, lifting some of the restrictions that they have right now, allowing them to be more aggressive and going out and earning money, we think that in the next few years, the Postal Service can be reshaped and be a far more profitable institution than it is right now.
So, Senator Sanders, how did it come about that the Post Office got stuck with this an onerous burden of having to pre-fund future workers' retirements?
I will tell you how. Because President George W. Bush said he would not sign the bill unless that was in it. And that's the simple truth of it.
Well, then what was the motive behind it? Is that one of those notions of privatization that will...
I would say, yeah. You can argue that and certainly there are a number of Republicans who are pretty clear that they want to destroy the post office as it currently is. They don't believe government should be involved in this type of activity. That's certainly one of the motives. You can argue that it's an anti-union effort. We have some strong postal unions, and if you're a Republican, you may not like that at all. So I think those are certainly some of the motivating factors there. But the bottom line is, I think it would be a real disaster for this country if we lost post offices all over rural America. And I'll tell you something else, Ian. If you slow down mail delivery service, which is what happens when you shut down half of the processing plants in this country, what you're really doing is beginning the death spiral for the post office. Because right now, clearly they're in competition against email, and they're losing their competition. The response is not to slow down mail service anymore. If you're a business person and you're told, well, you know, when you mail your packages, it may not get to its destination until 2 or 3 days rather than one day, you're going to say, you know what, I'm not going to use the Postal Service anymore. I'm going to go someplace else. So there's going to be less revenue coming in, more cuts, and we're not going to have much left in a few years. The good news is, I think, is that because of the fact that the fund, the future retiree health fund, is now in strong shape, the fact that everybody recognizes the Postal Service has overpaid into the federal employment retirement system. There are some negotiations going on now between the union and the Postal Service on health care, which can save money. You add all that together, we have now a window of opportunity for the next 3 or 4 years to maintain a current mail delivery service, maintain our rural post offices, maintain Saturday service, and transform the post office into a very different entity. Let me give you some examples. I come from a rural state. If in Vermont you walk into a post office, a rural post office, and you say, I would like this letter notarized, postal clerk would say, sorry, we're not allowed to do that. Oh, I would like 10 copies of this letter. Sorry, we don't do copying. Could you wrap my gift that I got in Christmas packaging? Sorry, we don't do that at all. Can I get a fishing license or a hunting license? No. We're not allowed to do that at all. What about cashing a check for me? Well, can't do that at all. What about strong email service? I want to send a very important statement to the West Coast, and I want to make sure that it's going to be private. No one's going to look at it. No, we don't do that either. So if you look at what's going on in Europe and around the rest of the world, post offices have significantly expanded what they do above and beyond just delivering mail and packages. In terms of delivering mail today, every day, our mailmen will deliver mail to about 160 million doors throughout this country. Could they be doing more? The answer is yes, they could. So what we need to do is to bring together some very smart entrepreneurial types to say, okay, this is how we can give the post offices opportunity to bring in more revenue. This is how we can expand what our letter carriers are doing. I think if we do those things, you can re-energize the post office and bring in significantly more revenue, so you don't need these devastating cuts.
And interestingly enough, Senator Sanders, in Japan, the post office is the biggest savings accounts, has the biggest savings accounts in Japan. One of the many services you just mentioned that the post office could have, I think it used to have, actually.
That's right. No, that is exactly right. But just, I mean, an example. You're in a rural area. You need to cash a government check, if you like. Right now, the Postal Service is not doing that. Why aren't they doing that? Plus, many, many other activities that I think they could be doing.
So why is it then, Senator Sanders, that in President Obama's budget, 2013 budget that he unveiled yesterday, why is he backing the ending of Saturday mail and boosting stamp prices?
Well, this is kind of where he is echoing the major piece of legislation here in the Senate, which sooner or later would end Saturday mail and shut down rural post offices and so forth and so on. What I have been trying to do with some success, and we now have a pretty strong majority, I think, of the Democratic caucus, and I think we have some Republicans who say there is another approach. So I think what Obama has bought into is what had been the dominant feeling, which I think no longer is that the only solution to the financial problems facing the post office is part of this cut, cut, cut. Saturday mail delivery service is one, shutting down processing plants the other, shutting down rural post offices the other. He has bought into that. But I think we now have a majority members in the Democratic caucus. You got some Republicans who are saying, is there another way that we can go forward to solve the financial problems of the post office and yet retain the integrity of this agency, which has been so important to the American people?
But there's also an inherent contradiction in much of what the president was talking about yesterday. It wasn't an austerity budget, which we've seen what damage that's done in Europe.
Yeah.
It was a stimulus budget. And he talks about the need for more jobs and a lot of jobs in terms of infrastructure that he's put forth. Yet at the same time, we're talking about 220,000 jobs that the post office will lose. I mean, we've already had a tremendous hemorrhaging of public employees' jobs throughout the country.
Decent paying jobs in many cases, the union jobs. So you're absolutely right. Why, in the middle of recession, when we spend every day here and the president is telling us how we have to create jobs and create jobs, would we be talking about shrinking the postal service by 220,000, including, by the way, many veterans? So I think you're right. It is inconsistent with the overall message. But all I can tell you, the president's budget, for better or for worse, is a series of recommendations. And I think what you're seeing here, at least in the Senate, is a majority of the Democrats are saying, we think there is a better way to go forward in terms of saving the Postal Service.
Well, just in closing, Senator Sanders, I know you've been working a lot on trying to figure ways to overturn Citizens United. We've already seen the disastrous results of that Supreme Court ruling with the creation of these super PACs that are dominating this 2012 election. I get thousands of pieces of mail from all kinds of progressive organizations all the time, and what I'm noticing is that there are all kinds of progressive organizations around the country trying to figure out ways through a constitutional amendment and other means to overturn Citizens United, but I don't get the sense that there's any cohesion, that there's a game plan, that there's a strategy here.
Well, we're working with a number of these organizations, including Public Citizen and some others. What you're seeing right now, Ian, is in towns and cities throughout this country, resolutions are being passed. You're going to see some action at state legislative levels urging the Congress to pass the constitutional amendment. I and others have introduced, I think, strong and effective constitutional amendments. So I think you are going to see a lot of grassroots organizing around this enormously important issue. You're absolutely right. And by the way, what I have to tell you is you ain't seen nothing yet. They're playing around, when people made this big deal that Sheldon Adelson had put $5 million and his wife $5 million into Gingrich's campaign. This is a family worth $22 billion. $5 million is one day's profit for them. They could have put $50 million, they could have put $500 million, and it really would have been very little skin off their nose. So we have not yet seen anything, but we are clearly moving toward a situation where every significant candidate in this country is going to have a sugar daddy, is going to have a billionaire or corporate sponsor, and that is just unspeakable in terms of the destruction it's going to bring to what many of us believe American democracy is supposed to be. So I can't think of a more important issue than A, overturning Citizens United. B, we don't have to wait till that happens. That's going to be a difficult process. Right now, I expect to see legislation on the floor of the Senate which says, if you're going to run an ad, if you're a corporation and you want to run an ad, you're going to have to do what every candidate does, what I have to do if I run an ad, and that is say, I approve this message. You do that one simple thing. You demand that corporate America, the CEO, is on that television set. You know what? You're going to very substantially reduce those ads. There are other things that we can do to ameliorate the disastrous implications of Citizens United. So overturning it is the long-term goal, but legislation right now to minimize its impact is something we've got to do and can do.
Well, that's good to hear because it's a very high bar. A constitutional amendment takes a long time, and this is a problem that has to be addressed right away.
So. Absolutely. And I just people, what you're seeing now, and you're quite right, people are waking up to this because you're looking at Romney has Wall Street super PAC contributors, and Gingrich has, the Adelson family, and Santorum has his particular sugar daddy. And this is only going to get worse, and you're going to see it in this campaign, and it's imperative that Congress act immediately to reduce its impact.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Senator Bernie Sanders.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders was elected to the United States Senate in 2006, serving Vermont after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about China's new leader's visit to Washington.
Right there, that's the postman asleep in the sand. He's got a get well call to deliver. He's going to do it by hand. He's going to do it. 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 He's going to do it by hand.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Perry Link, who holds the Chancellor's Chair for Innovative Teaching Across Disciplines at the University of California, Riverside, where he's also a Professor of Comparative Literature and Foreign Languages. He is one of the world's foremost experts on Chinese... He is one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, politics, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests of June 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. Welcome to Background Briefing, Perry Link.
My pleasure.
And today, the Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping has arrived in Washington, and he is the presumptive heir. So everybody's trying to get a feeling for him. First of all, what does it matter, Perry Link? Who's in charge of China? Is it possible that a personality could suddenly appear who could, change the country like, say, Gorbachev did the Soviet Union?
It's possible, I suppose, but not likely. And if it's possible, it's not because there's any way to tell in advance. In order to rise in the Communist Party of China, you have to learn to play your cards very close to your chest, even towards people very close to you, let alone to the outside world. So it's more or less like reading tea leaves to try to guess what's in the mind of Xi Jinping. And from all of the tea leaf reading I've seen, I don't see any grounds at all for expecting him to make any sharp turns.
Well, we know, at least from press reports, that much of what the Obama White House have said they've said or said they want to say has to do with human rights, and that's a perennial kind of source of friction between the U.S. and China. And there have been some recent Chinese brutality in Tibet. Not that China's treatment of Tibetans hasn't always been pretty brutal. But there's also the most recent source of friction, Perry Link, would be the Russian and Chinese veto of the UN Security Council's attempt to stop the Assad regime from killing its people in Syria.
Yes, yes. Well, the Obama White House has done a little bit better in the last 2 years in raising these issues, both in public and in private, than they had before, and better than the Bush administration before them. So I am guardedly optimistic that Xi Jinping will get an earload about human rights and about vetoing the resolution on Syria. Another aspect of the Syria situation, which I think serious people in China certainly observe and bemoan, is that this is a tremendous loss of face for China in the Arab world and around the world. The New York Times had a very good article about how people in Libya and Egypt are throwing eggs at Chinese embassies and so on for having done that.
Well, that's a bit odd, though, that China has been cultivating Saudi Arabia.
Yes, well, they... But China, you see, is many things, and what the government and its financial interests are doing can be quite different from what other sorts of Chinese people think and what people in Arab countries on the ground think. So I'm not sure that they really have their act together when they make a veto of a resolution on Syria.
So, Perry Link, what's your sense of the Obama administration's statement in terms of a strategic shift to Asia away from Europe? And accompanying that was the announcement that 2,500 Marines are going to be deployed to Darwin in Australia, as though 2,500 Marines are going to somehow check the growing power of China in Asia.
Well, on the whole, I think that that's a correct shift. I mean, if you look at the world today, if there's going to be trouble spots and a rising power that is unpredictable, it is in Asia, not in Europe. So on the whole, I think that was a fairly good move. And actually, I think the way they did it was fairly good, too. That is, to put the troops in Australia and to announce that we're having this Pacific shift, but at the same time trying to make it clear that this is not meant to provoke the Chinese leadership and that it's just a low-key thing for now.
Well, what is, though, likely to make China dangerous or confrontational in the coming decades? Most of what we've heard from our end in terms of China, the next superpower and its quest for a blue water navy and all that stuff. I mean, if you go back to the Bush administration, there was some very, very reckless behavior going on from Rumsfeld and Cheney and company and the neoconservatives trying to get the Taiwanese to cause trouble as though they wanted a new arms race with China. And fortunately, George W. Bush's uncle, Prescott, who's got business interests in China, was able to prevail. There's always been this kind of to and fro in American policy from the business community wanting more engagement and the military community wanting to gin up China as the next great threat.
I spend most of my time studying China, not the U.S., and all of what you said about U.S. politics rings true to me, but I am more comfortable addressing this from the Chinese side. There's several possible ways that trouble could get started. One is just over resources, keeping sea lanes open and keeping access to raw materials in Latin America and Africa and so on. And then there are these regional jealousies that are pretty long-standing in the South China Sea among Vietnam and the Philippines and China. And China's been, when I say China here, I mean the government, I mean the policymakers. I don't think there's a lot of popular support behind this, but the government is being more assertive and aggressive there, and this creates a bit of friction with Taiwan as well. Another problem that could arise has to do with Chinese nationalism. When the Chinese Communist Party completely lost its domestic credibility after the Tiananmen massacre for a while, one of the main sources they turned to recoup their credibility is nationalism, and they've stoked it through the Olympics and Rising China Image and so on. And this feeds, especially on the Chinese internet, among young people, a kind of ultra-nationalism that can even go farther than the party leaders would want, and it can sort of get out of hand. And that kind of unpredictable nationalist impulse, I think, could, in the wrong hands. And here again, the Chinese military, like the top leadership, is a considerable black box. It's very hard to read what people at the top in the military might want to do. But I don't see any big invasion plans coming out of China to take over the world or anything like that. But in a regional sense, to give Taiwan its comeuppance or to go get Vietnam for being uppity, I think that's a real danger. And this supernationalism that's behind it could be the fuel that makes it happen.
Again, I'm speaking.
By the way, that's why the Southeast Asian countries are more willing in recent months to cooperate with Washington, not because they're in love with Washington per se, but because they see it as a way to balance this unpredictability from China.
Again, I'm speaking with Perry Link, who is one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, politics, and people. He translated and edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and following the pro-reform student protests of June 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. I suppose it gets back to the question: is it more likely that China will be a global superpower, flexing its muscles outward, if you will, or is it more likely that the Chinese leadership, as my understanding is that we ascribe great power and great projection to them that they're going to be the next hegemon. But my understanding is most Chinese leaders are looking over their shoulder at their own restive population, and these deep contradictions within the country between the people in the inland, the people on the coast, between the government that they're trying to build and the Communist Party mafia who still runs things. Aren't there some big internal contradictions?
Oh, absolutely. You're completely correct about that. The question of where China is going to be 20 years from now is not going to depend on geopolitics, in my view, nearly as much as on what happens inside China. With the rise of the Internet, for example, the power of public opinion is considerably stronger now than it was just 5 years ago. The controlled press that was successfully controlled in all its various media for decades in China, from radio to television to magazine to books, the Communist Party always had a way to control it and throttle it. They can't do that with the Internet. It's becoming ever more clear that they can't do that. And the Internet is becoming an alternate source of news, so that you can say that now in China there actually is a semi-free press, or how do I put that, a half of the press, the part that's on the Internet that ordinary netizens do, is completely free, and it's catching up, and it's forcing the official state media to be more credible just because the Internet news is available, and people will all just believe the Internet if the regular media doesn't catch up with it. And this situation is getting beyond what the men at the top in Beijing can control, and they know it. And I think they're much more worried about that than they are about geopolitics.
And just turning to the economy and the extent to which China is arguably the winners in globalization have been the Chinese peasants and Wall Street, and the extent to which people are being drawn from the rural areas into these new cities like the big Foxconn virtual city there out just near Hong Kong. I spoke to a journalist yesterday who's done some investigation into Apple's relationship with Foxconn and the extent to which indentured students are being used by provincial officials for cheap labor, all kinds of kickbacks flying around. But you just wonder how long China, as its economy grows, can in fact depend upon cheap labor, and also the extent to which people are being exploited within. That's bound to lead to the one thing that the communists really feared is a trade union, right? That's one of the great ironies.
Right. Yes, people call the Chinese economy a miracle, and it might be, in a sense, a miracle, but it's certainly not a mystery. It's the combination, as you say, of a huge supply of cheap labor over the last couple of decades, although that might be running out one of these days, and then capital. And these people work for low wages, long hours, with no union, no OSHA, no workers' compensation, no independent court to turn to if they need to, no environmental enforcements. And as I just said, until recently with the Internet, no free press. So they really are in a bottle, as this article you referred to me about Foxconn clearly shows. People are almost indentured servants in these large cities that are manufacturing goods for international and national and internal Chinese capital. It's odd here that there's such a confluence of interests on the side of capital between international corporations and Taiwan, which is the owner of this Foxconn operation, and the Communist Party of China. And one must add what you'd call local mafia. Mafia is the wrong word. That's from Italian roots. But local is underworld in China that takes care of the thuggery that keeps people in mind. And the Communist Party and the thuggery and the international capitalists are all in concert here, not that they always like each other and agree with each other, but in concert in making this great economic engine run. And how long it can run is a difficult question because, as I said a moment ago, the supply of willing laborers, or in some cases only semi-willing laborers, is running thin. And then with the Internet, the exposure of abuses is attracting more attention inside China than around the world. There is a lot of reporting in China on the social networks about this and that abuse, and almost reflexively, Chinese netizens, when they hear these reports, side with the ordinary people against the power elite. It's almost a reflexive reaction. So how stable this is a big question. And the fact that the top leaders know that it's not stable is clearly visible in the resources they've put into controlling events. The budget for what's called in Chinese Weiwen, maintaining stability, is now bigger than the military budget in China, the domestic stability control budget.
Well, just in closing, is there an analogy then between the leadership and particularly the generation of the so-called princelings and what's happening in Russia, where Putin, the ex-KGB man, seems to regulate the oligarchs? Is that what's happening there with the Communist Party top brass regulating these new billionaires?
In a very broad sense, I think it is, yes.
I see. Well, Perry Link, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Perry Link, who holds a Chancellor's Chair for Innovative Teaching Across Disciplines at the University of California, Riverside, where he's also a Professor of Comparative Literature and Foreign Languages. He is one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, politics, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests of June 1989. In 1996, the Chinese government blacklisted Perry Link. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the father of non-violent... we'll take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the man who inspired much of the Arab Spring revolutions. Well, thanks again, Perry. So this will be up at ianmasters.com later tonight.
Okay, take care.
Thanks a lot. Great. Bye-bye. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gene Sharp, who is the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He's the author of more than a dozen books that have been translated into 45 languages and has had a direct effect on nonviolent resistance tactics around the world, from Serbia to Iran to Egypt and Russia. His works include Gandhi as a Political Strategist, Waging Nonviolent Struggle, Nonviolent Action, and his new book just out is Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflicts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gene Sharp.
Thank you, Ian.
And we've spoken a few times in the past, and at this point there is a real, I think, test for nonviolent struggle going on in Syria, in as much as the original protests against this Assad family rule in Syria began as a nonviolent protest that was brutally repressed by the government. And now it seems to be slipping into a situation where there is an impending civil war because the government left no room in terms of any other form of expression or political space. So obviously, given what's happening there, what would your response be to the argument that at a certain point, when you're dealing with intractable thugs, a nonviolent struggle doesn't work?
But that's the naive response and naive thought, if we can call it that. The government does not determine what the nonviolent group can do. They can make some types of action heavily priced, so to speak. They can make severe repression, but the nonviolent struggle people can do what they decide to do. And sometimes in nonviolent struggles, there's a very heavy price to pay. That also applies, we should remember, and more so to violent struggle. Just because you shift over to violence doesn't mean your opponent's going to be living you. But the casualty rates in violence conflicts are always vastly longer, more severe than occurs in facing nonviolent struggle, although those also can be difficult.
So at the end of the day, it almost feels like you're asking human beings to be better than what they are. I mean, this is a really high bar, isn't it, to be able to face guns and tanks from a modern army that's the dictator's prepared to use against his own people?
Well, that's the nature of those regimes. If you want to get rid of them, they're not going to love you. If you say, we want to change, we want you to go. They don't then say, okay, we'll go. Bye-bye. You know, nothing like that. Those regimes are such that they often came to power through violence and often maintained their situation of violence. And when challenged, and challenged severely, as can be done by nonviolence, so more effectively than by violence, then those regimes will use the violence against the nonviolent resistors. And that's a heavy price to pay, and we must admit that. But the Syrians, quite remarkably, have said repeatedly, I am not afraid, I am not afraid. And you've got to take that army committing those atrocities away from the regime. And you can't do that by a civil war, possibly. You may wage civil war and lose. And you cannot win by just doing nothing. You have to use that struggle very carefully and wisely. And the one way that can be done is getting the army in a situation it will mutiny and refuse to obey orders, as has happened in several revolutions, notably the Russian Revolution of February 1917, massive disobedience. And this is something that people have to calculate, how they're going to show, and we know that from the beginning.
Well, it does.
But one other thing. I think it was two or three nights ago on CNN I saw in Europe. There was an impression given that the army is now starting to waver. Some people have mutinied and walked out already. Some of those have then tried to turn their guns on their former buddies. That doesn't work too well. But the report was that the army is now not unreliable as yet, but verging on the unreliability, and that the regime is extremely worried about that possibility, much more so than they are the possibility of the soldiers going over and waging a civil war.
So I guess in summary, Gene Sharp, before we get to your new book, Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflict, just because we're touching on Syria because it's so much in the headlines, you're arguing that had the struggle remained nonviolent, it might have taken longer to get rid of the dictatorship, but there'd be less death all around. Is that a summary?
No, it's not. Sorry. And the chances are, if the struggle had remained nonviolent, the struggle would be shorter.
I see. And what's the logic? What's the logic behind that? I'm sorry to be
because you take the army away by the army refusing to carry out orders to repress and slaughter civilians in their country. And the way you do that is by maintaining nonviolent discipline. Regimes put agents into dissident groups and dissident armies, soldiers walking out, in order to turn them over to violence because they have the capacity and the weaponry and enough reliable soldiers to do that. But by nonviolent, so it's a myth that it takes forever. That's a myth that I thought was gone because of the struggles that happened very quickly in Tunisia and Egypt, for example. But in this case, would be likely to be much shorter than a civil war waging for many months with massive, massive casualties and massive physical destruction.
So I guess, in a way, Gene Sharp, I'm reminded of the scene in the wonderful film about Gandhi, where the workers go on strike. And the police beat them, and then as they beat them down, more workers step forth in a nonviolent, passive way, and eventually the police simply can't mete out the punishment anymore. That's the argument you're making.
Well, that's a little optimistic phrase, but it's something like that.
Right.
You see, if you go over to violence, the soldiers are on the receiving end of that violence. I'm not going to send messages of love and kisses. They're going to fire you back, and that's what you must avoid. It's when they fire back that the resistance must continue, but nonviolently, because soldiers being shoot back. So avoid shooting at the soldiers in the first place so that you can get them in position of walking out and disobeying the regime.
So let's again remind the audience I'm speaking with Gene Sharp, who's the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution. His new book just out is Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflict. This is a dictionary that has an enormous body of work in terms of all the terms that one would want to know to associate with war and nonviolent struggle. And I barely know where to begin. Let me begin with one of the words in here that's come into our lexicon, into use a lot in many ways, propelled by the Occupy movement, as it's called, and that is oligarchy. Given that your work has influenced, Gene Sharp, much of the nonviolent revolutions that we've seen take place from Serbia to Iran and Egypt to Russia, how would you consider the Occupy movement in the context of these other revolutions that have taken place, in as much as what strikes me as a similarity is that the Occupy people refer to, in the same way that the young Egyptians and others say, we want our future, the word dignity comes up a lot, and we feel that a group of kleptocrats and oligarchs have stolen our future. And in many ways, that is the argument here in the United States by the Occupy movement.
That is probably accurate. But you don't define the nonviolent struggle movement by what the people want. You define the struggle by what people do. And that's a major difference. The idea that you're planning your struggle so that it's going to contribute to changing things, but simply occupying a physical space of territory or part of a city, a square, for example, and staying there does not change the economic system. It can arouse major sympathy and awareness that a lot of people are dissatisfied with the degree to which the political system is responsive to what they're interested in and dissatisfied with the massive maldistribution of wealth in the society. Here in the United States, obviously, I heard that in England and Norway is something that's happening in Europe, you know, and this is simply expressing your opinion strongly, that's not changing. You have to develop a strategy considering what are your clear objectives and how you're going to get them, how you can really produce the changes that you want. And that's heavily influencing. You can find lots of guidance on how to do that with some tips that won't answer all your questions. But our publication, it's on our website, AIGen.org is self-liberation. It's a guide to strategic planning to remove a dictatorship or other oppression. And that requires you to do a lot of thinking and a lot of reading. And it gives you a chance to form yourselves, not outsiders, but to yourselves form a new means of struggle and a new strategy for your struggle.
So what explains, though, there's a fundamental difference between the United States and England, where you've just been, and the movements that are taking place there, demanding change and redistribution of wealth, etc. The fundamental difference between, say, Egypt and the Arab Spring and what's happening in the West is that the Egyptians and the brave young Arab men and women, they don't have democracy and they want it. But we have democracy, but we want better democracy. What is your analysis of why it is that we in the West have allowed our democracy to atrophy?
Well, that's beyond my personal capacity to judge. I'm sure there are many scholars who should be tackling that question, and I'm sure that many people are, but I don't have answers to all the problems and all the difficulties and all the second and third level of questions, but that merits attention, and you've got to give attention to that as part of your planning. What can you do to correct the situation? Well, that began a long time ago when I first had this defined terms from my master's thesis in sociology at Ohio State University. Because without clear terms, you can't think clearly. And our terms have been very, in this field of nonviolent struggle and many types of conflict, terms have been sloppy. They meant several different things, including the opposites, you know. And so I had to define terms, the nature of the types of ethical and religious nonviolence. It's not just one category, but there are about 8 or 10, you know. And somehow you get over and something as complicated as nonviolent struggle to remove serious oppression, then that works in very complicated ways. I think nonviolent struggle, contrary to some devotees, is more complicated than is violent struggle. The way it works, the means you can use, and how you can get the results you want. So you have to know what you're talking about or you're thinking about. And if you do that, then you have a chance to be able to think. Without that, you can't think clearly at all. So that continued from way back. That would have been starting that in 1950, probably, or 49 or 50. And then that went on through the development of the big book, The Politics of Nonviolent Action, published in 73. And then how does this operate in certain countries under certain kinds of oppression, under totalitarian regimes, under milder dictatorships, milder oppression, and it operates in different ways. So I just kept adding terms, and I finally brought some of them together fairly quickly after 73. And those were revised again at least 3 times. So the final manuscript then was quite large. That's why there are nearly 1,000 entries and about 880-some or so defined terms. And an introductory essay on the violence and realism, nonviolent struggle and realism.
Again, I'm joined by Gene Sharp, who is the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution, and he is an author of more than a dozen books that have been translated into 45 languages and has had a direct effect on nonviolent resistance tactics around the globe, from Serbia to Iran to Egypt and Russia. His latest book is Sharp's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflicts. And you just mentioned Libya. I guess Libya is in many ways a test case, right, for where your notion that that they should have stayed with the nonviolent resistance as opposed to a civil war with outside help. And there's still a bunch of militias running around in Libya shooting at each other. So the situation is far from clear. And you made the point that the casualties were much, much higher in Libya than they have been in Tunisia and Egypt, where there was no resort to violence. So am I correct in suggesting, Gene Sharp, that you think Libya is a test case for your thesis?
No, I wouldn't, because that attempt, there was an attempt originally that I don't know a lot about, to use nonviolence over in Libya. That was very early on, boom, 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 it's gone, that possibility. And why? Because a prominent Libyan general, very important in the Gaddafi regime, defected. And remarkably, he defected with all his soldiers and with all his all their weapons. And then he goes to the rebels and say, here, I'm here to help them with this. And that is, was a very suspicious defection. Gaddafi and one of his sons 2 weeks earlier were defecting the nonviolent civil war, which is civil war. He was producing civil war by the defection. And what was achieved by the regime was to kill off the nonviolent sorrow component and just leave this general and his troops and their guns in place to be used supposedly against the Gaddafi regime. There was this, I met a Libyan authority when I was in London just a couple of weeks ago. She has a new book out. I forget the name of the book. But there was suspicion in the rebel camp that he was, in fact, a high-level agent provocateur sent into the rebel camps with his guns and troops to force, in by the situation, for pressure the resistance to abandon nonviolent means and go to violence. So, and he was later killed, reportedly not by the rebels who did suspect that he was a provocateur, but also by the other people who, because he had been killing off people from a certain Muslim group, and they were taking revenge on him. But I think that case is not relevant to the effectiveness of nonviolence so, because it was derailed very early on, and also by the rebels accepting those guns, thinking that would be quick, and of course, that's nonsense.
So in other words, Gaddafi manipulated the situation to make sure it was a violent struggle.
That's my interpretation.
Right. So let's turn to Russia, one of the countries you've had a lot of influence in. Last time we spoke, Gene Sharp, I think you told me that the Russians under Putin had tried to prevent your books from being translated and distributed in Russia. Am I correct in remembering that?
Well, you got it mostly right.
Mm-hmm.
That referring that to one of my big books, but that was From Dictatorship to Democracy. We had not given permission to anyone to translate that, but despite that, there were four independent translations. And then when we discovered that, we also discovered there was a new fifth translation. And we encouraged that, we'll take that one, and this, if it's the best, and try to improve all the translation, put it together. And that new translation then went to a print shop in Moscow. And that was in the press. The presses were running. The FSB, the successor to the KGB, raided the print shop, ordered the presses to stop. The agent focused on, what is this? He looked at it, and he said, that book is a bomb. Stop. And so the rebels with the manuscript took the good translation outside of Moscow to a separate printing place where it was printed. When they brought that back into Moscow and was on sale in two distant bookshops in Moscow. And mysteriously, those two bookshops caught fire. You know, not everybody throughout the world, whether it's in Burma or anywhere else, really loves people struggling for their freedom nonviolently. And they will regard this correctly as the most severe threat to their control that could be made.
Well, one of the things, though, Gene Sharp, that I find encouraging about Russia is that there's always been an assumption that somehow the Russians genetically prefer an autocracy. They prefer a strong man, a czar, that somehow this kind of peasant mentality has been inculcated over the centuries. And it seems to be completely false, that the Russians have shown lately that they're very unhappy with the kind of modern capitalist, communist, hybrid dictatorship that Putin has managed to usurp, I guess.
I agree with you that they are not genetically inclined to violence. You just have to look a little bit at Russian history. 1905 revolution went on for a year. Overwhelmingly nonviolent and very, very courageous. Shootings of people in Palace Square and near the palace. In days when you had simple guns instead of machine guns, and something that almost 400 people killed on one day in that case. Then it was still remained nonviolent. And the great October strike that Gandhi learned from in South Africa. And he wrote, "We must learn to use this Russian method against tyranny." And then on in Russian revolutionary history, because that first revolution was derailed because Lenin and his cohorts wanted to shift the struggle to violence, and then they engineered the October strike in Moscow, not the October, but another general strike in Moscow, which would go over to violence, because then the same principle is in Libya. If you're shooting at their opponents of the regime who have defected from the army, and they're shooting at the remaining soldiers in the army, those soldiers of the regime will shoot back. And when they shoot back, they are supporting the regime, and that enables it to carry on.
And, of course, a bloody civil war followed almost a decade?
Well, not quite. Yeah. You had quiescence in terms of massive struggle after the end of 1905. Some struggle went on in 1906. Then it wasn't until February 1917, not October, but February, a massive revolution of all social classes, including the nobility and the proletariat, used nonviolence struggle and brought down the Tsar system there. Violence in the Tsar had nothing to do with it.
Right, but there was a civil war that followed.
There was a civil war after the Bolsheviks.
Exactly.
The coup d'etat in October, and then there's a civil war. That was not because of the February nonviolent revolution.
Sure. Well, it's wonderful to talk to you, Gene, and I'm so grateful, and our audience are so grateful for the work that you've done and the enormous effect it's had on this planet. I mean, what did you think of Time Magazine's Person of the Year, The Protester?
To be honest, I didn't see it.
Well, you're learning about it now.
Okay.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us and for your new book, Sharpe's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflict.
Well, thank you, Matt. You're always welcome.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Gene Sharpe, who's the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He's the author of more than a dozen books that have been translated into 45 languages. He's had a direct effect on nonviolent resistance tactics around the globe, from Serbia to Iran to Egypt and Russia. His works include Gandhi as a Political Strategist, Waging Nonviolent Struggle, Nonviolent Action, and his new book, just out, is Sharpe's Dictionary of Power and Struggle, Language of Civil Resistance in Conflicts. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.